It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, cinephilia, movie love. You know how sometimes you fall in love with a movie so much you watch it over and over again? Well, some movie fans take that devotion to a whole other level. For instance, remember The Shining? Stanley Kubrick's creepy movie about a writer and his family in a haunted hotel. There are ghosts and rivers of blood, and then Jack Nicholson tries to kill everyone. It's pretty scary. Well, it turns out there are some super fans who have watched The Shining 20 or 30 times, even frame by frame, and they found what they believe are secret clues, messages that Kubrick hid in the film. And now there's a movie about those obsessed fans. It's called Room 237. Made by director Rodney Asher. New York Times film critic Manola Dargis thinks it's kind of creepy and kind of fascinating.
He talks to five different movie fans, all of whom have kind of far-out ideas about the movie. It's a documentary, I would say, only in quotation marks, in the sense that they're making all of this up with this material that they've watched. It's like we are so deep in movie land that inside the movie that we're watching, Room 237, we never have a cutaway to some person like Jeffrey Cox, who's one of the people who has a very wild interpretation of the movie. You never cut away to see him speaking in, let's say, his living room. You know, there's no talking headshot of him sitting in an office in the real world. So for me, it's a kind of acknowledgement that the movie and everything that we're listening to has no reference in the real world.
And since I'm trained as an historian and my special expertise is in the history of Germany and Nazi Germany in particular, I became more and more convinced that there is in this film a deeply laid subtext that takes on the Holocaust. I think it probably was the typewriter, which was a German brand, which might seem arbitrary, but by that time I knew enough about Kubrick that most anything in his films can't be regarded as arbitrary. And so that struck me. Why a German typewriter?
He thinks this is a reference to the German bureaucratic killing machine, or what else? The number 42 keeps showing up on sweatshirts, or he actually counted the number of times Jack's wife, Wendy, swings the bat at Jack Nicholson. And it's 42 times, which he thinks is a reference to 1942.
Yes, the film historian David Bordwell has a really useful term that I like. He says that one of the things that critics do is that they create model films. And what they basically are doing is they're reconstructing the movie, making a mental model of the movie. But it's a very selective model, because what they do is they emphasize certain details and de-emphasize others or just ignore other things. And so I think that of all of the different people who speak inside of Room 237, that Jeffrey Cox has the best and most plausible model film. And, you know, if you think about a little model ship, he's made a model film of The Shining, a kind of a separate film that he has constructed from all of the cues and the patterns that he has picked out in the movie. But what that means is that he's ignoring a lot of the other stuff in the movie. And I think that's a really interesting thing because, as I wrote, this is kind of movie criticism at its most delirious. And for me, it's kind of interpretation gone wild, you know, or criticism gone wild. You see something in a movie and you latch on to something that speaks to you personally, and then you kind of siphon all of that material and you go back with all of that material and you start making a secondary, a shadow movie, a model movie that based on all of that material that's interesting to you. But in order to do that, you have to ignore a lot of other things. What's astonishing to me is how deep people go. There's an entire interpretation about the moon landing.
The carpeting on the floor during the famous Danny scene where he stands up with his Apollo 11 shirt, the patterns in the carpeting exactly match Launch Pad 39A, you know, even the driveway and everything. And if you notice in that shot, the pattern on the rug changes when Danny stands up.
One of the reasons I wanted to go back to The Shining is like, wait a minute, does the pattern on the rug really change? it really does. So, you know, when I see something like that in a movie, my default position is usually that's just a mistake. That's
right.
A kind
don't you
of
just think continuity mistake?
Exactly. That's a blooper. That's something that's going to show up on one of those internet websites. I don't then, therefore, decide that it's a portal into an entire world of meaning.
Well, one of the things that I think is so interesting about listening to these different interpretations is my take on it was, well, this is kind of weird, like a weirdly twisted version of what we all learn to do in college English classes, right?
Yes.
You're taught to read novels deeply and to look for images and symbols and to think about linking those up. Nobody ever suggested that the novelist did it on purpose. In some cases, novelists, of course, are conscious of the way they're using symbols and images, but the assumption always is that there's a great deal that we do when we're creating something imaginary that we're not fully aware of, and that's the delight of interpretation. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think of that in terms of this film?
I think this is taking the intentionality to a point of madness almost. No, I don't mean madness like, I mean it in a kind of, in a very playful way. There's nothing bad really about these interpretations. I think they're faulty. I think they're kind of silly at times. I think they're foolish. No harm was done. It's fine. What I think it's interesting is movies teach us how to watch them to a certain extent. There are all sorts of ways in which they cheat time and space. And we learn just by watching movies how to read them through editing, for instance. A lot of movies won't show you someone walking up to a door, opening the door, walking through the door, closing the door. You'll just have a cut from someone in the hallway to suddenly they're in the room. And what we do is that we understand that that person has gone through the door. Mm-hmm. Movies, they cheat that because they only often have 2 hours, if we're lucky, mm-hmm. to make their meaning. So they're compressing time and space. So there's a lot of cheating, and we learn how to do that. What's interesting is that for some viewers, it's not enough what the movie is telling us. And I think that that's really important. The movies tell us a lot of things. There's a lot happening on screen. And I think one of the problems with just mainstream criticism often is that we're not looking at what is there, the visible evidence, as it were. We're not just paying attention to what's on screen. We're looking kind of casually at the movies and then just running off. And some of this is understandable. I mean, most movie critics are still just watching a movie, let's say, just once. You know, unlike these fans in Room 237, you know, when I review a movie, I'm usually going to a screening room. I watch the movie once, and then I have to go home and I have to create my mental model of the movie. I have to summon it up, look at my little chicken scratch notes, mm-hmm. and try to remember what in the world was I writing in the dark, and imagine it. But I'm trying to understand what I saw. I'm trying not to take these great imaginative leaps because I think that we do a disservice sometimes to the movie. And so while I find these interpretations amusing, I think particularly because I am a movie critic, I also find myself frustrated when I see other people doing that when they're writing about a movie, what this movie really is about, quotations around really is about. We saw that recently with Gone Girl, people not just looking at Gone Girl as for what it is, but saying what it really is about.
And on the other hand, there's something kind of beautiful about the way these fans, the attention that they bring to the smallest details and the smallest images in the film. One of these fans is ABC News correspondent Bill Blakemore, and he reads The Shining as mainly about the Native American genocide. And one of his big pieces of evidence is that there's a Calumet baking powder can.
And I think my visual imagination looked at the Calumet baking powder can, the one right behind Halloran's head when he's talking to Danny. I knew what Calumet meant. It meant peace pipe. And I thought to myself, peace pipe, Indians. Oh my goodness, they're all over the place in that movie.
I would never have even noticed that baking powder can or the fact that later you see even more baking powder cans. And I kind of like having noticed that.
Oh, I think it's great. I only get irritated, I think, with other professionals when they take these kind of leaps sometimes. What I'm saying is when they're not actually paying attention to what's on screen. I think why I did love this movie, Room 237, and why I think of it as delirious is the playfulness. And it is, I agree, I think there's something quite beautiful. I love that they're looking at the details. I think fundamentally it says more about Bill Blakemore than it does about Kubrick, I would argue. I don't actually think that it's about the genocide. The kind of confidence with which he puts forth this interpretation is really quite a lovely thing. But I think that's because I think fan love, unless it's demented, is quite lovely oftentimes. And there's something about Kubrick that just brings out this kind of devotion, I think, as a testimony to Kubrick himself.
Manola Dargis is co-chief film critic for The New York Times. The film is Room 237, just out on DVD. And if you want to watch it, Manola actually suggests a triple feature. Watch The Shining, then Room 237, then watch The Shining again, just not before bed. So who's your favorite filmmaker, or at least a filmmaker you're obsessed with? Steve Paulson would put Werner Herzog near the top of his list. Herzog's the legendary German director who made arthouse classics like Aguirre, The Wrath of God, and Fitzcarraldo, as well as hit documentaries like Grizzly Man. He makes movies on kind of an epic scale. The late Roger Ebert memorably said even his failures are spectacular. Herzog has just come out with a book about his life and philosophy called A Guide for the Perplexed. And Steve, of course, had questions.
Mr. Herzog, I want to start by asking you about your 1972 film, Aguirre, The Wrath of God. Did you actually threaten to shoot your lead actor, Klaus Kinski, at one point during the production?
I did, yes, but there was a clear understanding between us. The production was very, very complicated, and we actually had a very small crew in the middle of the jungle. Something like 10 or 11 days before the end of shooting, because a sound assistant smiled and he screamed at me, "This pig has smiled at me!" And I had to dismiss him. I said, "The entire crew is going to leave in solidarity." And he packed his stuff into a boat and was leaving. And I said to him, "Klaus, I have your rifle." I had to confiscate it because a few days before, some of the extras were playing cards after shooting. They were playing cards and they laughed and they had a beer. And he was annoyed by this and shot 3 shots through their hut, but the walls were only thin bamboo walls. And 40 of them were packed into this small hut. That he didn't kill anyone is a miracle. He only shot half a finger away from one of the extras. And I said to him, "Klaus, you are not going to leave. There's something bigger than the two of us." And he screamed and yelled, "You will see how I'm going to leave." And I said to him, "If you do that, you will just barely reach the next bend of the river and you will have quite a few bullets in your head." And he knew I was not joking.
Are you serious? I mean, would you have shot him if he had gotten on that boat to get away?
Let's not get into that, but at least I voiced it. And at that time, I think I was serious, otherwise he wouldn't have all of a sudden screamed for police to protect him against this madman. But I was very calm. I was very, very calm, soft voice. I explained to him that this was not going to happen. But of course, you will read everywhere on the internet that from then on I directed him from behind the camera with a rifle pointed at him and all this kind of thing. Let it blossom. Yes, that sounds fine.
To skip ahead then a few years, you and Kinski
yes.
were once again in the Amazon filming Fitzcarraldo, another incredibly difficult project. And this is another film about obsession. And the centerpiece of the film is dragging a 340-ton steamboat up a mountain.
Yeah, over a mountain.
Over a mountain, up and over a mountain. And, you know, the big question is, why did you think that you literally had to drag that ship over a mountain? I mean, you could have created that effect on film, and that's kind of what movies do. They create illusions, but you dragged that ship over the mountain.
At that time when the film was made, there were no digital effects, so let's face it. But, of course, there were possibilities with a miniature boat over a mountain, but how do you miniaturize the trees of the jungle? So that's a tricky thing. Or how do you miniaturize movement waves of water? That's very, very hard to do. But that was not the real issue. For me, it was something more fundamental. I wanted to have audiences back in a position where they could trust their eyes again. And it's a monumental task, and you will never see anything like this in a film because today they all do it with a digital effect. But moving a real ship over a real mountain created so many lively elements and moments that I captured on film that you couldn't even invent. For example, the sound. When we started to drag the ship and there were steel hawsers, cables and pulley systems around the hull of the boat, and the kind of groaning of the boat and the sounds of the boat is something you will never ever be able to invent. It's just phenomenal. So the film became very rich in texture, and I knew that.
And one of the things that is so extraordinary about your career, and I can't really think of any other filmmaker like this, you have done both feature films and documentaries, I mean, at the highest levels.
It shouldn't give you sleepless nights. Because when you look at writers, for example, why is it, I don't want to compare myself, but I just name him Shakespeare, why does he write dramas and why does he write sonnets? Or why is a writer writing a novel and poetry? There's nothing special about that.
But it would seem that these are two very different things. I mean, one would presume that documentaries are grounded in the imperative to talk about real things, and feature films are dealing with fiction.
No, I do not accept your definition, because that's what you see day in, day out on HBO and PBS and so. It's a form of journalism. You are talking about a form of journalism, and I think documentaries have to divorce themselves from journalism. Errol Morris is doing it. Les Blank did it. I'm doing it. And I think my basic approach is facts do not constitute truth. That's a common mistake. They don't. Otherwise, the phone directory of Manhattan, 4 million entries, would be the book of books. It would be scripture, and it is not. So I'm looking after something that is only partially based in fact, but I stylize, I invent, I script, I write some of the scenes. I do everything that goes much closer towards, let's say, feature filmmaking.
Are you in pursuit of truth in your documentary?
In a way, yes, but you have to be very cautious about it, because neither mathematicians or philosophers could really define what it is. But we all have this sense in us. What I'm trying is to move towards in this direction. And truth is something which has to illuminate you. There are moments of almost ecstasy where you step out of yourself and you immediately sense there's something very, very big, and it becomes part of yourself. And I have coined the term the ecstasy of truth, the ecstatic truth.
Have you had many personal experiences of this yourself, of these ecstatic moments of truth?
Yes, of course. And I think everyone has these moments when you read a great poem, you instantly know. You don't have to analyze it. Or being confronted with a great painting, you just are completely awestruck and you are transported somewhere, which is as if you have lifted off the ground and you are somewhere and you are confronting this image. Or in music, great music, it has, not only can it illuminate you, it also has a quality that's particular about music. It can give you consolation.
I'm interested in all the examples you've given are not about your own films that you make.
No, but I'm trying to find these moments, and I'm striving for cinema that gives you this kind of illumination at least once in a while. Mm-hmm. And also a sense of solitude, that all of a sudden you don't feel alone anymore.
Now, I want to ask you about one documentary that you did. Everyone I know talks about this, is kind of obsessed about it. It's the story of Timothy Treadwell, who for years went to live with grizzly bears in Alaska pretty much every summer until one summer when he and his girlfriend were killed and eaten by a grizzly. As a filmmaker, why did you want to tell that story?
I had no idea about the events around Timothy Treadwell. I had never heard of him. And in the office of a producer who was very friendly with me and was very helpful, I paid him a courtesy visit. And at the end of our conversation, I was looking at his messy table, looking for my car keys that I had misplaced. And he thought I was spotting something in particular, and he shoves across an article about Timothy Treadwell and said, read it at home. I normally don't read this. I went home, read it. I was right back in the office because I had the feeling this was big. This was so big, I had to do this. And I somehow wrestled the whole project away from them, and I did it together with them. But you can tell as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, you know it deep inside that you come across something that is truly big. And the film has had a lot of impact.
Well, and Treadwell, I mean, he's this fascinating character. You admire him for what he did. He himself was a filmmaker. He shot amazing footage of the grizzlies.
Be warned. I will die for these animals. I will die for these animals. I will die for these animals. Thank you so much for letting me do this. Thank you so much for these animals, for giving me a life. I had no life. Now I have a life.
But you know, there was something odd and probably off about him as well. I mean, he should not have gotten that close to the grizzlies.
Sure, yes. There are rules of behavior in the native population, for example, in Kodiak Island. They respect the bear. They don't love the bear, but they respect the boundaries. But Timothy Treadwell wanted to hug them and even touch their nose and sing songs to them. So there's something wrong, something awfully and tragically gone awry, where the Disneyization of wild nature ultimately cost him his life and, unfortunately, also his girlfriend's life, Amy Huguenard, who was with him. It's very, very tragic, a tragic sort of misunderstanding of philosophy and misunderstanding of wild nature. And of course, when you say, yeah, he was kind of unhinged and sometimes glorious, and so he had at least 5, 6, 7 more facets, a very strange, colorful man with a lot of different sides in him. And I allow him to show all his sides, his glory, his dejection, his fears, his magnanimity, everything, madness, yeah. Everything.
Now, one of the things that makes this film so poignant is it turned out that Timothy Treadwell's camera was on as he was getting killed, he and his girlfriend. I mean, the lens wasn't open, but the audio was going, and there are 6 minutes of audio as he's getting mauled and eaten by the bear. And so the question for you is, what do you do with that? How do you deal with that morally?
You can see it in the film. I had to address it because production company, TV station, which sponsored the film, and the distributor, they all came to me and they said, you have to address it. It is known in public. Why don't you play it in the film? I said to them, I have no idea what's really on this tape. Let me listen to it and I'm going to film this moment. But I'm filmed only from behind. And you see the face of Jewel Palovac, who was the companion and co-founder of Grizzly People, and she inherited all these tapes.
I hear rain and I hear Amy, get away, go away.
And she tries to read from my face what I'm hearing, and she starts, it's a very intense moment, she starts to cry, and I listen to the tape. And the moment I listened to it, I knew this is not going to be in my film, never ever, that's not going to happen.
Can you turn it off? Julie, you must never listen to this.
I know, Werner. I'm never going to.
And you must never look at the photos that I've seen at the coroner's office.
I will never look at them.
Yeah.
They said it was bad. Now you know why no one's gonna hear it.
I think you should not keep it. You should destroy it.
Yeah.
I think that's what you should do.
Okay.
Because it will be the white elephant in your room all your life.
It's the same thing. Why do we not show in public on television after the 9/11 attacks 200 people jumping out of the towers to their death, some of them in close-ups crashing to the ground in front of a camera? There's a dignity to one's individual's death and a privacy. You will never, ever show this in public. And a similar thing, you have to respect the death of these two persons. And it is so terrifying, by the way, it's so terrifying what I heard, that certain things you do not put out to an anonymous audience. You just don't. And there's a clear line, and I said, only over my dead body, this is going to end up in the film. And they understood it.
But you felt like you had to listen yourself.
Well, I was pushed to, and yes, there was a certain curiosity, and I can say one or two things. On the tape, you hear Timothy Treadwell in the distance screaming. And apparently Amy Huguenard, a petite woman who was from moment one afraid of grizzly bears, she apparently grabbed a frying pan, rushed out and hit the bear with this frying pan over the head. And at the place where some of her remains were found, there was also the frying pan. This is real heroism. She lost her life, but she lost it as a true, genuine, authentic hero.
Do you still think a lot about Timothy Treadwell?
He comes across me whenever I see an animal, a wild animal, or whenever I see wilderness. He's always there.
Werner Herzog is a living legend among filmmakers. Stu Paulson talked with him after reading Herzog's new book, A Guide for the Perplexed, Conversations with Paul Cronin. And hey, if you liked it, we posted Steve's longer conversation with Herzog on our website. That's at ttbook.org. Coming up, what goes on inside the head of a man who wears a giant puppet head? We'll find out next. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International. One of the weirdest side notes in pop music history was an act called Frank Sidebottom O'Blimey Big Band. Was a British group led by Chris Seavey, a man who was only ever seen on stage in a giant papier-mâché head, kind of like a human cartoon hybrid. Writer John Ronson played keyboards with the group for about 3 years in his 20s, and he tells this story about how he answered the phone one day. Some guy says, "Hey, Frank Sidebottom's keyboard player is just canceled, and they need someone to play tonight." John says, "Well, I play keyboards." And the guy says, "Then you're in." John says, "But I don't know any of your songs." And there's a pause, and then the guy gets back on the phone, and he says, "Well, can you play C, F, and G?" John tells what happens next in a book, a new movie, and here with Doug Gordon.
It was like a dark room, and I knew that he wore a big fake head. And so I saw these men staring at me, and I wondered, you know, if I looked closely, would I be able to see which one was Frank? Would there be some kind of facial indication that this is the man who always wears the fake head?
Yeah.
And they were, like, fiddling with equipment at the front near the stage. And then I looked to my right and I noticed this other figure in the shadows staring at me with these huge eyes painted onto a giant fake head. He was wearing the fake head, even though there was nobody in the room except for his own band, who surely had seen him without the head on. So immediately I started to think, what, does he never take it off?
Yeah.
Is he, like, possessed? So I knew his real name was Chris. So I said, "Hi, Chris, I'm John." And just silence. So I said, "Hello, Frank." And he went, "Hello." And then his manager came over and said, "Can you teach John the songs?" So he turned away from me as if kind of shyly undressing and removed the head and removed some weird, messily contraption that was underneath the head. and then turned and gave me this sort of apologetic smile as if to say, you know, I'm sorry that you had to witness such oddness, but that's just the way things are in my world. And he taught me the songs, and he was just normal looking underneath, just a nice, normal looking man.
Mm-hmm.
And then the audience arrived, and I was on stage with a band. And it was extraordinary. There was 300 people in the audience and they just loved it. And I loved it. And I felt like Alice chasing the white rabbit down the hole.
Did Frank introduce the band members?
Yeah, so it was a kind of odd moment because Frank said, you know, I'd like to introduce the band. Drums, Mr. Mike Doherty. Yeah. And everybody kind of cheered. And on guitar, Rick Sarko. And everyone cheered. And they said, I'm on keyboards, John Rodson. And there was a much less vociferous cheer, just a smattering of slightly confused applause. And I thought, I haven't done anything wrong. And yet there's 300 people in this room who have all seemed to have formed this collective negative judgment of me that I don't deserve as much applause as the other band members. And then I understood that, concerned that I didn't know any of the songs, they'd put me so far to the side of the stage and turned my keyboard so quiet that 90% of the audience didn't even know there was a keyboard player on stage. So I thought, well, why do they even ask me to join?
Yeah. Okay, so tell me about the man under the head of Frank Sidebottom, Chris.
Chris Seavey. He was a punk singer who never really had any hits. He had one, actually two minor punk hits. And then one day he just had this strange U-turn into Frank Sidebottom. He created this character and an entire world for this character. He'd be up all night building Frank things in his shed, so little models. There was Little Frank, his puppet, and then Little Denise, who was Little Frank's girlfriend. If you're the sort of person who admires the idea of like putting in an awful lot of work, but at the same time really aiming low and really being marginal, then Frank's the person for you. Because he dedicated his life to this, but never had a big audience.
How different was Chris Seavey when he was himself versus when he was Frank?
Chris was quite chaotic and hedonistic and prone to drink and drugs. And Frank was like an innocent child. It makes me suspect that all this happened for a reason, that when you're inside a fake head, and also when you're inside the character of an innocent child, it's just a more comfortable and safer place to be than without a fake head in a chaotic, hedonistic whirlwind of a life.
Yeah, he's just able to immerse himself in this alternate universe that he has control over.
Yeah, yeah. And no stress, no tax to pay, no disappointed wife that you've been out all night and you haven't told her where. You know, mm-hmm. Frank was a safe place to be.
Yeah. When did you leave Frank's band?
I was fired in 1990 for tax reasons. He owed £30,000 tax. Chris did, not Frank. Yeah, in Frank's world, there was no such thing as tax.
No, no such thing as income tax.
I remember that he stood up in court, Chris, and the judge said, this is a very serious matter. Have you considered a payment plan? And Chris said, would £1 a week suffice, my lud? The judge said, no, it would not. So he fired us all and went solo. And that was it for 15 years. I moved back down to London and didn't hear a word for 15 years. And then I was in the park with my little boy and my phone rang and I said, hello. And this voice went, hello. And I said, Frank. And he said, oh, yes. And I said, how are you? He said, oh, I'm very well. And I said, Frank, will you put Chris on? And he went, hang on. And he said, hello, John. He'd retired Frank a number of years earlier and became an animator on Pingu. But he really missed Frank and wanted to bring him back from retirement. So I held my breath because I knew from watching the Blues Brothers what was going to happen next. It didn't happen. Instead, he said, will you write something about your time in the band to help me with my comeback? So I got home and it all just sort of flooded out of me. this piece for The Guardian. And then at the time, one of my books, The Many Stoic Goats, was being turned into a film. So I was spending a lot of time with the screenwriter, Peter Strawn. And when he read my piece, he said to me something kind of weird. He said, all my life I've wanted to write a film about what would it have been like if Captain Beefheart had been around in the 1940s, like a man out of time. He said, but your idea is better. And he meant the idea of a man with a big fake head.
And turning that into a film. So how did you go about doing that? You co-wrote it with Peter.
Yeah.
It's fictionalized. It's not a documentary per se. You had to make some creative changes to the story, right?
Yeah, I think we started by making two big changes. One was that I didn't really want to write about a comedy band. I wanted to change the music. I should say all this was very much with Chris's blessing. He didn't really want there to be a character based on Chris in the film. Mm-hmm. So that really gave us permission to say, well, OK, what would be the perfect way of telling this story? Chris never took himself that seriously, even though he was up all night for months building these meticulous Frank things. If everything went wrong and it was chaos, he would purport to love it when things went wrong. And we thought, wouldn't it be better if our Frank and his band took themselves much more seriously, almost like craft work, like a sort of krautrock avant-garde band?
Yeah.
So that would like raise the stakes a lot. And so we made that change. And then we started to say, well, what if our Frank never takes his head off? Why would that be? And also how can you live underneath a fake head your entire life? And then we started thinking about other great outsider artists, particularly Daniel Johnson, who I'm an enormous fan of.
Yeah.
And so we started thinking of our Frank as like a mashup of Daniel Johnson and Frank Sidebottom and Captain Beefheart.
Have you ever tried on the Frank head, John?
Yeah, and also I've tried on the movie Frank head. There was a New York premiere and Michael Fassbender was there and let me try on the fake head. So I've tried on both the real head and the fake head. And I've got to tell you, it feels great in there. I was at a Halloween party last year, which was full of quite famous people, and I wore a mask. And I realised that if I kept the mask on all night, it would eliminate all social anxiety. And I rather wish it was socially acceptable to wear fake heads quite a lot. It made my life a lot easier. Unfortunately, violent criminals have spoilt.
Yes, they've kind of taken that away from us. But maybe if enough of us band together and with the success of the film and your book, maybe if we all start wearing Frank heads, maybe we could make it socially acceptable.
Would it help if I said my facial expressions out loud? Welcoming smile.
Delighted look.
But what goes on inside the head inside that head?
Frank, people should know about you. You should be famous.
Flattered grin, followed by a bashful half smile.
Stop saying your facial expressions out loud. It's extremely annoying.
Here it is, my most likable song ever. Coca-Cola, lipstick ring, go dance all night, kiss me, just kiss me, Nefertiti.
This is your most likable song ever?
Yeah.
People will love it.
That's a clip from Frank, a film inspired by John Ronson's experience as a member of Frank Sidebottom's band during the late 1980s. Ronson's book is called Frank, the true story that inspired the movie. He talked with Doug Gordon. And coming up, an exploitative skin flick that failed at the box office in 1965 is enjoying a second life as a cult classic.
Ladies and gentlemen, go, go for a wild, wild ride with the Watusi cats. But beware, the sweetest kittens have the sharpest claws. For your own safety, see faster, pussycat. Kill, kill. Wild women, wild wheels. Race the fastest pussycats and they'll beat you.
I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Russ Meyer was a film director known for his sexploitation films. They were full of campy humor, clever satire, and women with very large breasts. Most of them were successful. But in 1965, he came out with Faster, Pussycat, Kill, Kill. It was an immediate flop. But now, 50 years later, it's a cult classic. Dean DeFino is the author of a book about the film, and Doug Gordon talks with him about why Faster, Pussycat, Kill, Kill is worth watching, and even rewatching.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
the word and the act, while violence cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains sex. Violence devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet violence doesn't only destroy, it creates and molds as well. Let's examine closely then this dangerously evil creation, this new breed, encased and contained within the supple skin of woman. The softness is there, the unmistakable smell of female, the surface shiny and silken, the body yielding yet wanton. But a word of caution, handle with care and don't drop your guard. This rapacious new breed prowls both alone and in packs, operating at any level, any time, anywhere, and with anybody. Who are they? One might be your secretary, your doctor's receptionist, or a dancer in a go-go club.
Dean, can you give me a brief summary of the plot of Russ Meyer's film, Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill?
I would start with Russ Meyer's own strapline for the film, which is on the poster, where he describes it using four words. Superwomen belted, buckled, and booted.
Yeah, that sums it up.
I'd be a little bit more descriptive. This would be how I would design that strapline. I would say a trio of thrill-seeking go-go girls with a taste for violence tangle in the desert with a paraplegic, murderous old lech.
You girls a bunch of nudists, or you just short of clothes?
Or thigh, darling.
Why don't you take one of each, son? They both look tender. He's got a big motor to feed.
He sets up a hierarchy in the first actual shot within the film. The three go-go dancers, and they are Tura Satana, who is actually a stripper and dancer, who plays Varla, who's presumably, at least as far as I'm concerned, the leader of the group.
All right, here's how it works. Everybody's got to go.
There's Laurie Williams, who is actually an actor in Elvis Presley films. She plays Billy.
10% of your action be enough for anyone.
And Haji, which is her only name, and she plays Rosie.
It's got nothing to do with the money!
Haji was a fellow stripper that knew Tura Satana very well. In the opening shot, we see the three of them dancing on an elevated stage above a group of drooling burlesque house patrons.
Yeah, go, baby, go!
Go, baby, go! Go, go, go!
That's right, yeah. So it essentially sets up the power relationship in the film, that the women are seen as sort of objects of desire, but they're also perceived as being in a dominant position, and the men are kind of groveling at their feet.
Let's go now, harder, faster!
Why did you want to write a book about a film that was critically lambasted when it first came out? Some critics called it an exploitative skin flick. Was there any trepidation?
Trepidation, that's an interesting word. Let's just say that I didn't tell a lot of people I was writing the book while I was writing it, because I got a lot of dirty looks when I did. But really, it was in part for that reason, because it had been lambasted and because it had been rejected. I found that often work that draws critical vitriol ends up being really seminal. But really, the primary reason was the way that the film initially impacted me. And again, so much of the critical impulse is about searching out the reasons things excite us.
So how did it impact you?
One of the things that I would say right off the bat is I didn't know while I was watching the movie why it impacted me. And I think I can say now at least two reasons why I think it continues to do so. The first is that it plays with old patriarchal stereotypes of female power that we're sort of familiar with in the story of Amazonian women and sirens and Medusa and so on, which are all these sort of castration anxiety stories. And the second is that I think Meyer, and it's one of the reasons I think that Meyer is so important in the history of American independent film, very skillfully employs the elements of film form to tell his story, that his framings are very precise, his shot compositions and editing, his masterful use of music, his economical pacing. He's very good at drawing the viewer into his story, regardless of how ludicrous that story may be at times.
You have this great description of the cinematic universe, the film world in which Faster Pussycat takes place. You describe it as the sort of desolate wasteland one might expect to find in a zombie movie, co-scripted by F. Scott Fitzgerald and Samuel Beckett. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, I'm kind of proud of that line.
You should be. Well, look good on T-shirts and coffee mugs. There's merchandising potential there.
Well, we'll see. One of the overriding themes of modernist writers like Fitzgerald and Beckett is the notion of the existential desolation of the modern world. And you see this in the wasteland that separates West Egg from New York in The Great Gatsby. You see it in the backdrop of Waiting for Godot, which is essentially a tree beside a desolate road that links nothing in particular.
I see existential desolation every time I look in the mirror.
Well, it's a theme that we've begun to embrace again, and this is sort of where I think Meyer comes in. His landscapes embody the same desolation, but rather than leaving his characters to wait in it or to contemplate its meaning, he releases a monster, actually several monsters, into the landscape, and they move relentlessly, driven almost entirely by a violent orgiastic impulse. And I think to a large extent, the success of The Walking Dead recently proves that this idea is pretty durable. Whether we see it in sort of as an evocation of Cold War fears, as you do at the end of the 1960s in Night of the Living Dead, or of consumerist culture in the follow-up to that, Dawn of the Dead, or as a kind of fear of viral epidemic in 28 Days Later or World War Z, it is an idea that really does sort of stick with us. The notion that the world is desolate, but that desolation is also filled with dangers.
Your old man's been blasted out of his wheels, and your king-sized brother's been twisted like a pretzel. You're all that's left, lover, and you ain't gonna be around for long.
I don't believe it.
You better believe it.
And they're really, really, really strong female characters, especially Varla, played by Tora Setana. She's basically a sociopath and a monster.
Yeah, that's the language that I would use. And the reason I would define her as a sociopath is because she's able to entirely suppress her human empathy. So I mean a sociopath in a clinical sense, not just in a symbolic one. A monster in the sense that she embodies those castration anxieties, again, that we see in the Amazon and the siren myths, for example. She lures men in despite their better judgment and robs them of their power, that sort of a thing. But there's a really important distinction in Varla, I think, and what makes her a kind of modern figure. In the ancient version, these monsters are destroyed or thwarted by powerful men, but in Meyer's world, the men are fops and fools, essentially. And though Varla is eventually destroyed, ironically, at the end of the film, she's destroyed by the weakest of the female characters, who runs her over with a truck.
Yeah, what does that say about us that, like, Varla is by far the most colorful character in the film, and yet she's a sociopathic monster, yet we identify with her? Is that something conscious? Was Meyer trying to send us a message by doing that?
Yeah, I don't know if he was doing it consciously. I think we are, at some level, meant to identify with Varla as the figure of power in the story, in the same way that we are meant to identify with Jimmy Cagney or Paul Muni in the gangster movies, except that they are distinctly and patriarchally male, and Varla is not. So we sort of run into this problem of how do we find our place in the character of Varla, particularly if Meyer's audience is almost exclusively men at the time that the film is being made.
Yeah. In the process of writing the book and thinking about this, have you come to any conclusions about how do we find our place?
Well, I think we found our place gradually. I think the discourse is caught up with the film to a certain extent, as Ruby Rich claims in her review of the film in 1995 when it was re-released, where she talks about how when she first saw the film in the 1970s, it flew in the face of her idea of right-on feminism, but then filtered through the lens of the feminist and queer criticism that began to really sort of take root in the 80s and early 1990s, she began to see that Meyer's work was actually ahead of its time in the way that it dealt with representations of female power. But I think even more importantly, in our time, in 2015, how Meyer sort of reconsiders the idea of gender roles and gender traits. He saw his women as a sort of amalgam of traditionally defined male and female traits, in fact. Yeah. And at a time when issues of gender identification are so much a part of our public discourse, I think Meyer's films offer us plenty of food for thought.
You wanted to write this book to understand how and why Faster Pussycat Kill Kill spoke to some deeper, more sinister part of your brain. Have you reached any conclusions?
Well, to be honest, I'd rather keep them to myself and let you investigate the sinister part of your own brain.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, and there's a lot of territory to mine there. I'm still doing a lot of work there. I got to bring in some extra cartographers.
A cult film is built on paradoxes, and the one we most often hear is it's so bad it's good. In a great cult film, those paradoxes approach something close to the profound. And here is where I think Pussycat is a really good example. It's ahead of its time, but it's also of its time. It's both highly sexual and in some ways chaste. It's a mess of plot points and crazy dialogue, but you never feel lost in it. It's an amalgam of cliches from every popular youth genre of the time, including beach party movies and biker movies and juvenile delinquent movies, yet it somehow manages to hit you at a gut level. It's been read as feminist and anti-feminist, and I think that that's what makes it worthy of repeat viewing. And it's also one of the hallmarks of cult film, obviously. If the film isn't compelling you to watch it over and over again for the pleasure, but also to sort of help to mitigate the mystery of it in some way, to try to understand it better, or at least to become more involved in the mysterious thing that draws you to it, then it doesn't become a cult film. Cult film requires repeat viewing.
For an incredible evening's entertainment, a film so totally satisfying, see Russ Meyer's Faster Pussycat. Kill, kill!
Dean DeFino is an English professor and director of film studies at Iona College in New York. He's the author of Faster Pussycat. Kill, kill! He talked with Doug Gordon. That's it for this hour, but there's more online. And you can hear To the Best of Our Knowledge whenever you want if you sign up for the podcast. Visit our website and we'll tell you how. That's at ttbook.org. Today's show was produced by Doug Gordon. The rest of the team includes Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Charles Monroe Kane. Music by Steve Mullen from WalkWest Music. Audio wizardry courtesy of technical director Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Till next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.